This is the place in which radio loses something by not having an image for you. If you could see Tanner Colby, what you would see is your typical liberal, city-dwelling, possibly navel-gazing 30-something white guy. He's got a good education. He reads. Lives in Brooklyn, votes Democrat, loves Obama, thinks of himself as tolerant, open-minded, very liberal-minded.
Navel-gazing?
But at one point... he turned around, looked around himself, and realized, even though he lived in Brooklyn, which is admittedly one of the most diverse cities in the country, he had no black friends. And then he started asking his own friends, who were white, if they had black friends, and they didn't either. So, how did that happen? That question led him on a journey that led to the book called Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. And he joins us in studio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
First, I got to wonder about your choice of subject matter coming from somebody whose previous books were biographies of Saturday Night Live comedians. Why
right.
this?
Precisely because I'd run out of dead Saturday Night Live comedians. I'd sort of maxed out the genre. And I was getting pigeonholed there. Like, I was talking to publishers and editors and like, oh, well, you know, you do tragic dead celebrity stuff. Where's a Lindsay Lohan article? And I was like, my God, I've got to get out of here. So I was thinking about what else I wanted to do. And this was right about the time Obama won the nomination. And I realized, well, I don't know any black people. That's a little strange. And if we've had 40 years of school busing, affirmative action, all these things.
You were part of that school busing.
Yeah, I was part of that generation. So... we should have more black people in my sort of middle class white guy pipeline, and they were never there. And so I thought that using my life might be an interesting lens to look back on the last 40 years to see where America took a left turn. And because I was a white guy writing about race, you know, ignorance was the only qualification I needed.
Right.
So I could just start from scratch.
So let's start with you yourself, which is where you start in the book. Mm-hmm. Did you kind of come to a conclusion as to how you ended up in Brooklyn with no African-American friends?
Well, the Brooklyn piece of it is that I lived in Carroll Gardens, which is an old Italian mob neighborhood, which for many, many years, if black families just sort of knew not to go there. Though, interestingly, in the neighboring neighborhood of Cobble Hill, Spike Lee was the first, his family was the first black family in that neighborhood. But my neighborhood, no.
But did you have black friends in college? You must have hung out with,
No, Tulane. I went to Tulane in New Orleans, and Tulane is this little uptown island of whiteness and Jewishness. They call it Jewlane because it's one-third Jewish. No, seriously, because before Ivy Leagues admitted Jews, they would all go south to Tulane. It had a huge Jewish expatriate community from New Jersey and New York. So it's all southern rich kids and Jews from Rockland County, New York, and Secaucus, New Jersey.
So what's interesting to me is when you actually compared your experience with the average white American experience, what you discovered is that as opposed to Jim Crow, when there was all these laws in place that kept people segregated, mm-hmm. at this point, your average white person in America, without any effort, could stay isolated from racial diversity.
What I found is the first thing I did when I went online was I went on Facebook to look up all my old high school friends to get in touch with them to talk about our high school, which was a white flight suburb of Birmingham, Alabama, called Vestavia Hills, where our official school flag was a Confederate flag. That's where I come from. So nice. I sat down, and over a couple of days, I was like, well, should I email everyone? Should I send them questions? And then I said, wait a minute, I'm on Facebook. I can see how many black friends everyone doesn't have. And so I just started counting and looking at all the profiles of everyone's friends. And I counted up, took a couple of days and a couple of bottles of wine, but I counted up everybody's friends. And I counted about, 11,000 friends that were, related
friends
to
of friends, right?
Friends of friends. And out of those 11,000 people, I counted 156 black people.
Holy cow.
And of those 156, 17 of them were this girl, Tysley, who was the one black girl at our high school. So she was still everybody's one black friend 20 years after high school. So if you take her out of the percentages, it's even lower. It's less than 1%. And that's fairly universal across the country in many ways.
How did that make – when you realized this, what were the private thoughts going through your mind? What did you think about your own personal life at that point?
Well, my own personal life was that I just never tried, never thought about it. We were raised in a world, where very conveniently race didn't exist because white people had, fled the cities and created these little bubbles where you didn't have to deal with reality. And that's where we all came from.
But you also in the book examine certain programs, things like the GI Bill that you say actually made the problem worse. How is that?
Well, what happened with federal housing policy is that, well, it's a long backstory, but when blacks started moving to the cities in the 1910s and 1920s, you know, whites felt threatened. Because whites in the North had never really had to deal with blacks in large numbers before. And so the fact that whites felt threatened presented a unique business opportunity for real estate developers who saw that they could sell all white real estate at a premium. So they created these racial covenants. And it was a guy in Kansas City called J.C. Nichols that I profiled who really innovated. He was kind of the Steve Jobs of racism. He just sort of, you know, made all these innovations in how you could privatize all-white space. So whereas in the South, Jim Crow was like a legal system of apartheid, what they did with real estate was they turned segregation into a product that you could buy at a premium. And, of course, in America, once you put the profit motive behind something, it becomes very, very lucrative. And then just like health insurance companies run our medical system, these real estate developers came in and started dictating what federal housing law should be. And so, therefore, these housing restrictive covenants became federal law. And so when things like the GI Bill came along in the wake of World War II, when white soldiers came home, they could only use their GI Bill home mortgages in all white neighborhoods legally. They were not allowed to buy in the cities. And so this whole idea of, oh, let's go to the suburbs because that's the new American dream with the white picket fence, that was all advertising and that was all federally subsidized to make money for the people who own land out there. And blacks who came home on the GI Bill, their money was only good in all black neighborhoods. And even then, sometimes they couldn't get loans.
And you also talk about some things like let's busing, which was well-intentioned. It was intended to help fix the problem.
Well, it was intended to fix the problem, but busing started in the South in these small towns, where in the South, you have these small towns. There's not really any big cities outside of Atlanta. And people lived in relative proximity because they were legally segregated, but, you know, they were things are much, you know, closer together in the South. And the South had been using busing for years in order to segregate people. They put white and black kids and run these convoluted bus routes to like get them around each other.
Right.
And so busing started as a way to simplify the problem. All right, we'll just bus these kids to this school and this kids to this school. And it simplified it. Well, then they tried to translate that to these huge northern cities like New York City and Chicago and Detroit.
Boston.
Yeah. And the where it was largely a real estate problem. You had massive ghettos and huge white areas. And the logistics of what would have been required to shuffle all these kids around without having dealt with the housing problem that we just described was like crazy. It was well-intentioned, but it was completely beyond the pale of what, A, white people would accept, B, what was logistically possible, and C, also what black families wanted. Black families wanted the right to choose. You know, they wanted the right to have access to good schools, and they wanted good neighborhood schools. But, you know, you talk to the average black family in 1969 – they didn't want their kid sent an hour across town into some hostile environment where they didn't know where their kids were. So like 90% of whites were against busing, but like 50% of blacks were against it too.
So which is worse? I would assume that we're still better off than we were in the days of Jim Crow's when it was institutionalized, but it now is sort of an unconscious segregation. Is that as bad?
Well, what happened was that when blacks and whites came together in sort of social spaces like colleges and the workplace, there was just a huge backlash because we just weren't emotionally prepared for it. Legally, we had to do it. We had to, you know, force leverage to these resources for black Americans, but emotionally, white people and black people just didn't know how to deal with each other. And what's amazing when you look at the history of it is, you know, you have all these antagonistic forces like, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and you know, really sort of going after each other. But, you know, like in integrated neighborhoods like the one I profiled in Kansas City, like 4963 or Mount Airy, Pennsylvania, or Shaker Heights, even when blacks came and like tried to do the right thing, in this neighborhood in Kansas City, it was a 10-year conscientious effort, protect everyone's property rights, live together, get along. Even then, it barely worked.
Yeah.
Like they could barely coexist just because there was so much alienation and mistrust and who are you and I don't know if you're well-intentioned or not. But the amazing thing they managed to do in that neighborhood was because blacks and whites managed a ceasefire for 10 years, they created an integrated school for their kids.
Right.
And their kids grew up not
and
knowing
so the
any
next
better.
Generation. And one
right.
positive byproduct of your doing this book is you now have black friends, right?
And I now have many, many black friends.
And you got a great book out of it.
Tanner
Colvey, author of the new book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black, The Strange Story of Integration in America. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.